listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Today, an update of news and events from the Central, South America, and Caribbean region with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo. Well, first, before we get into this, we've got the report that came from Susie Dawson, who's been working on the solidarity actions with Julian Assange, that there was an attempted break-in at the Ecuadorian embassy with apparently someone intending to try to haul Julian out of the embassy and hand him over to the U.S. or whatever person they'd be handing him over to, foiled because of a booby trap that was set up inside the embassy by Assange to tip people off to what was happening. At the moment, he seems safe, but the government of Lenny Moreno seems to be doing some sort of, I guess you'd have to call it astroturf organizing inside Ecuador, you know, with some people saying, hand Assange over and, you know, get him out of the embassy. I don't think yet that he has popular support for that, though, and so we're just kind of watching that.
Right, but that's all part of what's going on in Ecuador itself generally, yep. Where it's absolutely clear that Lenin Moreno, Ecuador's president, has taken on a vendetta against every vestige of Rafael Correa's very successful previous administration.
Including Correa himself.
I'm sorry?
Including Correa himself.
Including Correa himself, yeah. I know Correa, I think it was last week, early last week, an attempt to get Interpol to put out a red alert for Rafael Correa, completely absurd, was rejected because it precisely because it was absurd.
Right.
But I mean, the attempts continue, and inside Ecuador itself, former Vice President Jorge Glass, who was imprisoned very much along the same lines as Brazil's former President Lula da Silva, basically because a judge, despite not having any hard evidence, thought that it was extremely likely that he would have been guilty of what he was accused of. And on that basis, Jorge Glas was condemned to, I think it was 6-7 years in jail. He's now on hunger strike because he was moved from, because he's not a high priority prisoner in the sense that he's dangerous, like the leader of a drugs cartel or something like that. Despite that, he was moved from a low security prison to the highest level security prison, with restrictions on visits and even interviews with his legal advisors. And so he's gone on hunger strike. He's been on hunger strike for 3 weeks now in his third week of hunger strike. And there's a lot of concern at the highest level internationally. Evo Morales has expressed concern about Jorge Glass's health. And Lenin Moreno has turned out to be such a vindictive individual. There's very little likelihood of any relaxation in the measures that are being taken against Jorge Glass. And to compound what the legal attacks on Rafael Correa, who's at the moment at least safe in Belgium, where he lives with his Belgian wife, and the legal attack against Jorge Glas. In addition to that, Lenin Moreno and his administration, his cronies in the legal branches that the government controls, are going after other relatively minor functionaries from the Rafael Correa administration, the previous Rafael Correa administration. It looks as though it's just kind of a general witch hunt against anybody who remains loyal to Rafael Correa and the ideals that Rafael Correa's political movement embodied, that Lenin Moreno has comprehensively betrayed.
Yeah, I mean, if this were the Soviet Union, they'd call it a purge. But that's what's happening.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think calling it a purge would be very much on the mark.
Yep.
And of course, that's the... But what's so... Also, in one sense, it's not surprising, but it's still disturbing that across the region, these legal attacks and other kinds of harassment of progressive political leaders are being carried out with such vindictive intensity. And you can see that in the way the Argentinian authorities are going after Cristina Kirchner.
Right.
And it's not, and you see, one of the interesting things is that any politician that expresses the least kind of support for the very concept of national sovereignty is being targeted.
Right.
And like, so you in Guatemala, you've got the ongoing power struggle between the government of Jimmy Morales and that section of the Guatemalan elite that supports Jimmy Morales, who very successfully moved against their rivals, another set of people in the Guatemalan elite, when they ousted Otto Perez, the previous president.
Right.
And that section of the elite in Guatemala supporting Jimmy Morales is now in conflict with the United States and its United Nations proxies.
Right.
Over whether or not the Guatemalan government will allow the Commission Against Impunity, which is a UN body in Guatemala, there's also a similar body in Honduras, to resume its normal operation with a head approved by the United Nations and the United States.
Right.
Because Jimmy Morales is refusing entry to the individual that was supposed to take up that post.
Yep.
So, and you see the same. So why is the United States, and why is it it's kind of the tool that it's using in Guatemala, which is the UN Commission Against Impunity, why are they targeting Jimmy Morales? Obviously because Jimmy Morales and that section of the Guatemalan elite aren't doing exactly what they're told.
That's right.
And so you have the same kind of thing going on in Peru, for example, where an outfit called CELAG, which is a very well-respected kind of center-left and generally quite progressive think tank research body, run mainly by people from Colombia and Argentina and other countries in South America. They don't have anybody from the Caribbean, which is why they sometimes get things wrong about Central America and the Caribbean. But they produced a study recently about Peru, and they found that in general there's a widespread disenchantment with all politicians in Peru. And of course that's a phenomenon that's current in many, many countries, including the United States, I should imagine. But in Peru, what is going on is part of the political process that's going on in Peru is an attempt by the elite to respond in a credible, plausible way to popular disenchantment with the political classes, and they've gone after Keiko Fujimori, who very, very nearly became Peru's president a couple of years ago, when she was running against Kuczynski, who was subsequently forced to resign from office because of his association with corruption.
Right.
Essentially because he pardoned former dictator Alberto Fujimori, Keiko Fujimori's father.
Right.
But Keiko Fujimori was the leader of a very strong right-wing movement in Peru, and now she's in jail classified as preventive detention because of her alleged involvement in corrupt activities involving campaign financing, as I understand it. But again, she wouldn't be in jail if the United States ambassador said that she shouldn't be. Okay,
right.
So you have to ask, what is it that Keiko Fujimori was trying to defend that the United States authorities didn't like?
Right.
Because I think that's something that, and what I'm trying to get across is that there's this general offensive, based, as you have said many times in previous conversations, based on this motif about corruption, that is used essentially as a political tool to eliminate people who are inconvenient for U.S. and allied elite interests in the region.
Right. Right. It's a non-ideological, quote-unquote, like on its face, it's a non-ideological weapon. Hey, look, we don't care if you're left, right, center, or whatever. If you're an honest, straightforward person, you're okay with us, and if you're a crook, you're out. Of course, I get to decide who's a crook.
Yeah, and that's the essential thing, isn't it? And as, right. as I was explaining last week, and between kind of trying to formulate the idea, which I have difficulty sometimes trying to keep the flow of ideas, keep running coherently.
Comes with age, doesn't it?
But the thing about that is that what the United States has done ever since the 1990s. I remember in the late 1980s when I worked in Honduras, in the early 1990s when I worked in Honduras, being puzzled about because the USAID was seen to be running really quite progressive human rights programs, human rights education programs. Mm-hmm. And back then, what are you talking about? 20, almost 30 years ago now. And I was just puzzled about what is this huge contradiction between them promoting this human rights education stuff and at the time, they were still running death squads in Honduras.
Right.
And so the answer is clear 30 years later. And what they were doing was laying the groundwork, laying the foundations to develop a class of functionaries in NGOs, in non-governmental organizations, and in the legal systems and criminal systems of their target countries, who are loyal to the ideal of and the needs of and the foreign policy imperatives of the United States.
Right.
And they carried that off extremely successfully across the region, to the extent that one of their star pupils, Silvio Moro, has now been invited by Jair Bolsonaro, the president-elect of Brazil, to be his justice minister.
Right.
Now, and this is a low-level legal functionary, a low-level judicial functionary, whose main claim to fame is the persistent legal harassment based on no evidence at all, based on false evidence that he concocted, based on breaking the law himself by violating all accepted judicial procedures, leaking information that was privileged and very selectively to right-wing media, making arrangements with right-wing media so that they would be on the scene for staged searches of Lula da Silva's house, processes whereby he'd have to go to Silvio Moro to be interviewed. All that Silvio Moro staged very carefully in media terms. And so you have this complete corruption of judicial process and accepted legal procedures by the person who is now being named by Brazil's fascist president-elect as the Brazil's new justice minister. And that is a glowing success for U.S. policy in the region in terms of its training and education program to put in place a class of functionaries that will do what they're told.
Well, you know, we've also discussed...
Or don't even need to be told.
Right, you know? Right. And it doesn't matter who's told what anyway, as we've discussed, because the media landscape, the entire communications apparatus, more or less in Brazil, in Argentina, in so many places in that region, privately owned by the oligarchy and the same people that own the judiciary. So, you know, you had the military dictatorships, the juntas, all of that, 70s, 80s, 90s, depending on which place, when, where, which junta, which military dictator, Pinochet or whoever, they selected a lot of the judges that still sit on the bench now and certainly set up the construct by which the remaining judges were selected. That's the judiciary and the reporting of, who did what, when, where, and how on their way in and out of court goes through press that's owned by the same character. So if you elect a leftist government, both inside the presidency and even, which they haven't really managed to do, but even if you elected a majority in the legislature, you still are at the whim of the right wing, the far right wing, the fascists, basically, who can say, that guy's a crook, they'll beat, play that from the rafters throughout the entire media scape, and a judge that'll say, yep, you're right, 20 years, and that's that.
Yeah, and the thing is that, if you look at why are left-wing movements and left-wing leaders in the predicament that they're currently in, it's because they were too nice, and if they'd been guilty of what they'd been accused of for around 10 years from between about 2006 to 2015.
Right, they'd be living in Switzerland.
They would actually have taken control of the judiciary. Actually have shut down the media.
That's right.
And they would have been able to protect themselves.
Yep.
Or take measures to ensure that it was much more difficult for the right wing than it was. They'd have shut down all those U.S. training programs.
Mm-hmm.
But because they were doing their best to be genuinely democratic, something that the right wing wouldn't know what it was if it hit them in the face.
Right.
Because they were trying to be genuinely democratic, they accepted the status quo and tried to work with the status quo. And they shouldn't have done. And if you look at what's happened in the archetypal example of how to do things is Cuba. right?
Yeah.
But the for countries like Venezuela and Nicaragua, that hasn't been an option.
That's correct.
In Cuba, they completely transformed the system, so there isn't a trace of the kind of bourgeois kind of institutions, the phony elections that are carefully, the elections themselves might not be rigged, but the whole electoral process is rigged, as we saw in Brazil.
Right.
I'm sure that the elections in Brazil, on the whole, were free and fair in the sense of the count. But as you pointed out last week, and they took place when, in a context where the most popular candidate had been locked up in a completely unjust way, the right wing media controlled the whole media campaign, and the fascist candidate who successfully won the election, Jair Bolsonaro, was allowed to break all kinds of electoral rules,
right,
in terms of his campaigning and his use of fake news smearing the opposition candidate.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were a whole series of factors.
Oh, and then, the input context for this is that the last elected leftist president was illegally removed from office. And so the election was conducted by some people who were in power thanks to a coup.
Correct. Another essential component to understand about what happened. What you have is a kind of completely phony democratic framework in which that has been in place, that was put in place following the military dictatorships of the 1980s. And left-wing parties and progressive movements have been trying to work in that. And much to the concern of the United States, who thought they had everything sewn up in the early 2000s, Hugo Chavez won the election in Venezuela in 1998 and proceeded to completely overturn, using that same democratic framework. He successfully overturned the bourgeois control of Venezuela's institutions,
right,
and by means of the Bolivarian Revolution, of which he was the visionary architect, he has enabled the Venezuelan progressive movement, and in particular the United Socialist Party of Venezuela, the governing party there, to defend itself by perhaps not having complete control of the judiciary and the central bank and an adequate media presence and all these things, but they have sufficient control to be able to neutralize attempts by the right wing to overthrow the government. And the same thing is true in Nicaragua. Now, if you look at what's happening in Nicaragua and Venezuela, it was very interesting the other day. I know. I think I put it up on the website. I translated it with a friend, Janet Pavone. We translated a long interview with Venezuelans and Bolivians participating in a peace and solidarity forum here in Nicaragua, in Managua. And in the interview, the journalist doing the interview asked them, "Well, what do you think about the experience that you've been learning about here in Nicaragua?" And they say, "Well, it's igualito. It's exactly the same as what happened to us in Venezuela."
Right.
The opposition thugs setting fire to people, burning people alive. The attacks on children. The roadblocks, which in Nicaragua are called tranques, and in Venezuela they're called guarimbas. These barricades that opposition activists set up to intimidate and extort the local population, and they said everything's the same. Even the lies are the same.
Right.
And so, what that means for anybody trying to understand what's going on in Latin America and the Caribbean is that they really do need to understand what has been the experience of Nicaragua and Venezuela and Nicaragua this year and Venezuela over the last 3, 4, 5 years.
Right.
Ever since President Hugo Chavez died back in 2013. And the experience has been that, for example, here in Nicaragua, that one big lie is there's no freedom of expression. Why do they promote that lie? Because the opposition have, they control the 2 or 3 main newspapers, they control most of the local radio stations, they control most of the local cable TV stations, and they have around half of the national TV stations.
Right.
So why do they claim that there's no freedom of expression in Nicaragua? Precisely because the fact that there is sufficient media presence on the part of the progressive government prevents them from completely brainwashing the population.
This is what they do too.
They almost achieved that via social media back in April.
Yep.
But that effect quickly wore off.
I mean, that's what they did during the coup in Venezuela in 2002. At the time, there was only one channel that the government had access to, and the remaining TV channels were all, you know, owned by the oligarchs. So that one of the first things that they did was knock out the transmitter at the government station so that the media portrait of the coup was portrayed entirely by the coupsters.
Right. And so, and in Brazil, you won't read about military repression in Brazil, not in the mainstream media. You won't read about police repression in Argentina. You generally won't read about military repression and police repression in Mexico, for example, although we're likely to read more about that now that a progressive president will be taking office on December the 1st. But in Nicaragua and Venezuela, you constantly read about military repression and police repression. Why are you constantly reading about that in the corporate media? Because the governments there control the armed forces and the police.
Right.
There, the police and the army support the government.
Right.
Why do they do that? Because the army and the police come from ordinary people and are loyal to their popular base.
Right.
They're not bought off like the police forces and the army in other countries.
Right, they're not professional, quote-unquote.
To serve the wealthy elites.
Exactly, they're not hired guards, basically.
So that is why the mainstream media in North America and Europe and Latin America, generally the corporate media, accuse the military and the police in Nicaragua and Venezuela of being repressive, because they don't control them. They don't answer to the imperatives and needs of the United States and other local regional elites.
That's right.
And why do they talk about corruption? Why do they talk about corruption in Nicaragua and Venezuela, but then they're not that concerned about it in the United States itself, for example?
Huh.
And just think about military spending in the United States and the corruption that's involved in that. But they will make corruption a key theme of their attacks on the Nicaraguan and Venezuelan judiciary. Why? Because they don't control the Nicaraguan and Venezuelan judiciary.
Right.
And so when you read people, when reading accounts in the mainstream media about events in Nicaragua and Venezuela, then they need to kind of be rational about what they're reading and critical about what they're reading, because otherwise it just doesn't make sense. Why would people rise up in Nicaragua against a government that's done more for ordinary people than any government in the last century, apart from the revolutionary government that was in the 1980s that was forced into a war by the United States?
Right.
You know, and the Venezuelan government, why do they keep winning elections?
Right.
Why does the Nicaraguan government keep winning elections? Oh, the mainstream media will say, oh, it's because they're corrupt and they rig the elections. Right. But unfortunately, international observers and international visitors accompanying the elections deny that. Even the Carter Center says that Venezuela's elections and electoral system is the best in the world.
Right.
You know, so, and so people reading coverage of Nicaragua and Venezuela need to be very critical about what's going on. And for example, the whole phenomenon of migrants in the migrants heading for the United States currently crossing Mexico, and the mainstream media coverage has been reasonably accurate in characterizing where they're from, but they really haven't said much about why are all these people from, in particular, Honduras and El Salvador, and also from Guatemala, heading for the United States,
right.
And why are they not vastly outnumbered by people fleeing this terrible, tyrannical, repressive, corrupt regime in Nicaragua?
Right. Well, look, that are the people that you know who have been murdered by their repressive government. Where were they from, and who, you know, in what country were they murdered? You know, Berta was
right.
Not murdered by the Nicaraguan government, for example. Others,
right.
You know, the same. The death squads are not in Nicaragua. They're not in Venezuela. They operate in Colombia. They operate in El Salvador. They operate in Guatemala. They operate in Honduras. These are products of U.S. training, arms supply, ideological orientation, and command and control, by the way, too, because they actually are right. operating as an extension of U.S. foreign policy, which is directed from the top. So, you know, for them to try to portray this stuff that goes on, that they make people rise up in Nicaragua as being some indigenous, you know, response to the insult of the governments, while they ignore the fact that people are running like crazy away from the U.S. installed governments in Honduras and elsewhere, you know, it makes the whole thing just too much to swallow. We're out of time, Tony, and we're going to have to leave it here. And maybe next week we can pick it up talking about what's been going on in the crisis in Costa Rica, the situation under Duque in Colombia, and maybe right. an update on what happens in Brazil, because we're going to be watching that closely over the next few weeks.
Okay, I look forward to that, Don. Thanks a million.
The same. Thank you very much.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Sophie & Co. I'm Sophie Shevardnadze. The United States has announced its withdrawal from the historic nuclear arms treaty with Russia. How serious of a setback is this for two countries' relations and global security? As contributing editor of The Nation magazine, professor emeritus at Princeton University, and author of the book War with Russia, Stephen Cohen.
Despite the latest clash over the mid-range nuclear missile treaty and new sanctions from Congress, the leaders of Russia and the USA are on course for a new face-to-face meeting, with more likely to come. Can personal diplomacy offer a way out of the dead end for the two great powers? Will the nuclear security born in the old Cold War survive the new one? And how will the world change if it doesn't?
Stephen Cohen, contributing editor of The Nation magazine, professor emeritus at Princeton University. Welcome to the show. Great to have you with us, as usual. It's been a while, but things change, so we've got a lot to talk about. I mean, last time Trump and Putin met in Helsinki, there were such big hopes. There are really, really big hopes that something would come out of it, that relations would improve. But not much really came out of the summit, and Donald Trump got a lot of flack at home for meeting the Russian leader. I mean, it's hard to expect a major breakthrough this time around in Paris. What do you think?
Well, there's a big struggle. Everybody knows about it going on in Washington over Trump's policy toward Russia. It would seem, and this has been the case, I think you and I talked back then when he was a candidate, that he said he wanted to cooperate with Russia. We used to call that détente. And that's been pretty much his policy, overall policy, since he became president. But he's also done contradictory things. And the question is, are these contradictory things the result of his own inability to be a consistent leader, or are people in Washington preventing him from doing what he wants to do with Russia? That's the big question at the moment.
What do you think? Is it him? Is it his, like, a mask of portraying himself as someone who appreciates Putin, but then, you know, behind the doors, he does whatever he does? Or is it really he's helpless and he has to do what the administration tells him to do?
I guess I've been following first Soviet and then Russian-American relations for nearly 40 years. I don't put a lot of weight or importance on whether the two leaders like each other or not. The real question is, do they see in each other a partner for their own politics, a partner for their own national security? So for whatever reason, Trump thinks it's extremely important to have a detente-like relationship with Putin. Now, remember one thing it's forgotten here. The three major episodes of detente in the 20th century were all done by Republican presidents, correct? Eisenhower, Nixon, and Reagan. Trump is a Republican president, maybe a strange Republican, but a Republican. So he's in the Republican tradition. On the other hand, you have in Washington today, I think more than I've ever seen in my long adult lifetime following this, such demonization of Russia and Putin in particular, but such anti-Russian feelings and lobbies with almost no pro-Russian lobby that Trump looks to be almost alone. Look what happened when he withdrew from the INF treaty. This was a big step. This was a historic decision.
We're going to actually talk about INF treaty
caused a ripple here.
And withdrawal in detail. But before we get to that, you just hit it on the nose because Putin has been invited to visit Washington in early 2019. What is the White House hoping to get out of this visit, seeing how Mr. Putin is so demonized, like by the American elite, like you've said, and the press?
Yeah. I agree with you completely if I understand what you're suggesting to me. I think it's a bad idea. Not that having the leader of Russia in Washington in general is not a good idea. We remember past visits. Even Putin was here early in his leadership. And we remember the welcome that Gorbachev got. It can be very positive, but Sophie, I tell you, you must know, sitting in Moscow, you must sense it, that we are in an unprecedented situation. The bad feeling, the hatred, the loathing of Russia, or at least the Kremlin or Putin, in the United States is so strong that it's hard to imagine what's going to happen when Mr. Putin, when President Putin comes here. I don't think it's the greatest idea. They'd probably be better off continuing to meet in foreign capitals, third capitals.
You mentioned the treaty. Trump administration wants to pull out of the U.S.-Russia treaty banning short and mid-range nuclear missiles. But judging by the latest examples, like NAFTA deal, for instance, attempts to deal with North Korea and the tariff war with China, Trump's personal art of the deal can be described as break first and then create a problem and then find a solution on his terms. In case of INF treaty, are we seeing the same game play out here?
Maybe. I think you're right. It is possible. We don't know if this decision announced to leave, and Trump announced it, and then his national security advisor, John Bolton, announced it again in Moscow. So outwardly appears that the United States is going to submit the documents. I think you have to give 6 months prior warning, according to the treaty, that you're withdrawing. So I think you're right. It may be part of a, quote, strategy or an art of the deal, as you say, to renegotiate the treaty in a way that Washington thinks makes more sense. But let us focus on the moment, Sophie, because you know this, because your grandfather was involved in this, Edvard Shevardnadze. In 1987, 30 years ago, 31 years ago, President Reagan and then Soviet leader Gorbachev did something historic that has never been done since. They abolished an entire category of nuclear weapons. Now, you and I may think that nuclear abolitionism, getting rid of all nuclear weapons, however wonderful the idea, is never going to happen. But imagine, remember, the precedent set 30 years ago when the two leaders of the two nuclear superpowers abolished for the first time then and ever an entire category of nuclear weapons. So that was the first act of nuclear abolitionism. What Trump has done now is abolish that precedent of abolitionism. So symbolically, politically, strategically, historically, this is a turning point if they're serious about this. And we ought to hope that they're not, that they want a new treaty in its place that might include China, that might include weapons that Russia's developing.
Right,
I don't know.
So
but don't miss the historic moment, Sophie.
Let's go through that in detail. But first, I just want to point out that some of the Russian military people and politicians here believe that the treaties related to nuclear disarmament were unfair and were signed on bad conditions during hard times in Russia's history. But now, surprisingly, we see that the American establishment also sees the NF treaty as unfair. Or so they say, because it damages national security. Has this treaty really run its course? Has it lost its value today? Like you said, maybe a new treaty is needed, actually, instead.
I will not give up my point that what was done in 1987, signed and then implemented, abolishing these weapons, was historic. Absolutely historic. A precedent that gave us hope for the future. Now, I agree with one thing that Bolton said, because it's true. When Gorbachev and Reagan, and your grandfather participated very centrally in that decision, in 1987, we were in a bilateral nuclear world. And today, we're in a multilateral nuclear world. That is, back then, only two nuclear superpowers had these kind of weapons. Now, a lot of countries, maybe as many as six, seven, eight, have these so-called intermediate-range weapons. So the treaty only affected two countries. But if something needs repair, but it's good, you try to fix it. I mean, if you have an illness, you go to a doctor, you don't commit suicide. You say to the doctor, let's fix it. Or you have a car that still runs well, but it needs a new carburetor. You replace the carburetor. You don't junk the car. So the question is, yes, there are complications with the treaty, but it is so important. Why not bring in China or try to? Or
well,
why not agree with Moscow?
That is my point.
If it's in violation.
That is my point, because you hear it in the American debate. And Sergei Lavrov said that the real reason for the U.S. withdrawal from the INF Treaty is actually Chinese mid-range missiles, which the U.S. sees as a threat to its position in Asia Pacific. Is Trump, by withdrawing from this treaty, hoping to put some missile pressure on China, really, and not Russia?
Maybe. And you're right. And whoever you quoted is right. China, because it is still operating as a regional power, not as a global power. It's emerging as a global power. But it's still operating strategically as a regional power, likes these missiles. Now, let's remind your audience what these missiles are. They are called intermediate range. It's a little bit, what does it mean, intermediate? Well, there are these battleground tactical nuclear weapons that are like artillery shells, short range. Then there are these monsters we all know about from the movies that can fly from Russia to the United States and the United States to Russia. Those are intercontinental. And the intermediate range is like, I forget the kilometers, but in miles, like 500 miles to 5,000 miles. So basically, they targeted Europe. That's where they were based. And Europe was the bullseye. And the politics of getting rid of them was centered in Europe, as it will now be again. But China now comes to this story newly. So any agreement would have to include China. Would that be hard? It would be very hard. But given the close relationship between Russia and China today, it's possible. Why not try? And the answer is because of the politics, not the security thinking, but the politics in Washington today. In one word, I am this month publishing a new book called War with Russia, with a question mark. And the theme of the book, and I put it in personal terms, is that the first time in my long life, at least since the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962, I think there's a real chance of war between the United States and Russia. And we can't assume that if that happens, it won't end in nuclear war. So that's why this moment you and I are discussing, Sophie, is so important.
Well, on that very dire note, hold your thought there. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back with Stephen Cohen, contributing editor of the National Magazine, Professor Emeritus at Princeton University, talking about the implications of the U.S. withdrawal from the INF Treaty for the global security. Stay with us.
Weekday World on CPR.
And we're back with Stephen Cohen, contributing editor of The Nation magazine, professor emeritus at Princeton University, talking about U.S.-Russia tensions. So we signed off talking about China, partially. Why hasn't this deal, INF, been proposed to China so far? I mean, U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton says Russia and the U.S. need to hold strategic talks about China missiles, which pose a potential threat to Russia as well. That's what he said. That's how he put it. Do you think maybe Washington is seeking to pit Moscow and Beijing against each other?
Well, you will remember, or I don't want to make you older than you are. You won't remember, but you've read about it, that during the Nixon years, the idea was to play the so-called China card against the Soviet Union, to woo China toward Washington and away from Moscow and the rest. There is no China card any longer. The old Kissinger idea that you could play off China against Russia is gone. Russia and China are becoming perhaps historic allies, economically, politically, militarily, strategically. This has happened due to a lot of factors. However, you're right. I mean, China now has to be included in any new nuclear arms arrangements that involve these regional or intermediary missiles. My own feeling is that the struggle over China policy in Washington is almost as intense over Russia policy, though it's less so because of our dependence on trade with China. The real question in my mind is what the Russian leadership wants to do now. If they really want to save this treaty, it's the Kremlin, I mean, the Putin leadership, that could negotiate first with China about whether China would join. But here's the problem, Sophie. All international politics is reaction, reaction to a perceived threat. If China perceives itself as being threatened by American strategic power in its region, it is never going to give up these regional warheads and missiles. So Russia, in my mind, becomes the key actor here. And we will see. Let's be honest, you have in Moscow, not you personally, but Russia has, people who are very happy about what Trump did. They want to build these weapons anew. And we have the same kind of people in Washington who are happy, who want to build these weapons anew. I don't know the political situation in China, but to a certain extent, there is a lot of political, financial power behind any decision that leads to building more weapons. And we're already in a new nuclear arms race.
So then
it's not, will we be?
And then there are Europeans, and they really aren't happy about the U.S. decision.
Right.
Fearing that they will once again become
right.
the target
that,
in the missile standoff between Russia and America. Can Europeans flat out refuse to place American weapons on their territory? For once in their life, can they do something on their own?
Well, back in the 1980s, it was the Europeans where American missiles were, these missiles were based and which were targeted by the Russian intermediate range missiles, the ones that the treaty got rid of but are now coming back. It was European politics that was partially driving the detente, the disarmament forces. Now, what do you see? First of all, we have to ask a question. Washington calls European NATO country our allies. Did Trump consult with European leaders before he left this treaty? Doesn't seem so. Secondly, you're right. The Europeans are upset. They don't like it. They're protesting. Why? Because they know they again will be targeted. So you raise a central question. Will European politics now play a role in what happens? And I would mention only one thing to you. What we see, if we sit back and look at the bigger picture, is Europe slowly drifting away from Washington in regard to Russia. Everybody says, oh, it's Trump. It's because he's such a bad president. This began long before Trump. It began partly over Syria, where Russia turned out to be correct. So the question is, will this new step by Trump to leave a treaty that protected Europe, it did protect Europe in the absence of these missiles, these weapons, will this now further push Europe away from Washington and continue its drift politically, I mean, toward Moscow. This is very important as well.
So the Trump administration has actually done much more than just the withdrawal, announced withdrawal from the INF treaty, to annoy Europeans. The Iran deal collapse made the Europeans suffer as well. Now the INF collapse makes them less safe, like you said. There's talk of a trade war, which will hit the EU harder than it will hit America. Has the current administration gotten into a habit of scoring points at Europe's expense?
The United States, under many presidents, has a long and growing habit of breaking its treaty and other promises. Now, the United States says it's going to leave a treaty again. After all, the United States left the even more important anti-ballistic missile treaty. Bush withdrew in 2002. That was the bedrock of Russian and American national security. That was folly. That's what led to this deployment of missile defense on Russia's borders. That's what led to Russia developing the kind of missile that Washington is now complaining about. It goes back to two events that are historical but also contemporary. The decision by Clinton to move NATO eastward toward Russia and Bush's decision to leave the anti-ballistic missile treaty in 2002. Everything has a history. But what Gorbachev and Reagan did, with the help of your grandfather when he was foreign minister, was to establish a new kind of trust 30 years ago. It's gone. It's gone. In a more dangerous world now.
So then there's the new START treaty. I know it's bad news. The treaty about strategic nuclear missiles. That expires in 2021. Yeah. Back in 2017, I remember Trump says that the deal was one-sided and bad. So after the INF treaty is almost dead, can the START treaty be dumped as well?
So you're getting me very upset because you're right. You're pointing out where all this may lead. We're talking today about one treaty that Trump, the struggle over this leaving the INF may not be over. As you said, maybe it's a bargaining ploy, art of the deal by Trump. But let's assume it's over. It obviously is going to raise questions about whether the United States, on the one hand, we'll want to renegotiate the START treaty. That has to start soon. But to the point I just made, Sophie, in Moscow, among serious people, not crazy people who don't want any agreements with the West, but serious people, they're going to ask again, can we trust the United States to adhere to any treaty it signs, including a new START treaty? So a kind of cloud of mistrust and suspicion and uncertainty has come over the one element of our lives that's existential, that is nuclear weapons. So you're right, we don't know.
I'm just also trying to figure out the thinking behind all of this, right? So in the context where the INF, the START, all these treaties were born out of mutual necessity, out of mutually assured destruction threat philosophy, and it's not going to be there anymore. With these deals now in question, do you think America is not concerned about the Russian nuclear threat anymore? Is this also what it's all about?
When I was writing this book, one thing that came to my mind that I hadn't noticed, but as I thought about it, it hit me loud and clear, that a generation ago, we worried about nuclear weapons and nuclear war all the time. Just look at the movies that were made back then in Russia and in the United States. The fear of the apocalypse, the fear that somehow, intentionally or unintentionally, a nuclear war would end civilization. I mean, our kids grew up with that. It was part of our lives. We don't hear much about it. I don't know in Russia, but in the United States, we haven't heard much about it for the last 15 or 20 years. This begins with Clinton when he tells us, because the Soviet Union is gone, everything's great. Well, everything wasn't great, and everything got worse. But there's not in the United States, and hasn't been, I would say, for 15 or 20 years, this concern about nuclear weapons, Russian and American, that something could go horribly wrong. Now, here, if we're looking for a bright spot, and it's desperation on my part, maybe what Trump has done, withdrawing from this really important treaty that protected all of us, will arouse in the United States a remembrance and a rethinking about the danger of nuclear war. For example, we used to have in American politics a very strong so-called anti-nuke movement at the grassroots. People, rank-and-file citizens, ordinary citizens, who participated in politics against nuclear weapons. That disappeared, that movement. Might what Trump has done reawake or bring that movement back in American politics? Yeah. Maybe. We don't see it yet.
Well, maybe it's a key word here. And also, like, in the first half of the interview, you said that the arms race is already going on. You actually mentioned this in your latest book as well, War with Russia. So last time it took several decades of nuclear arms race and a couple of scary incidents before U.S. and Soviet leaders came to realize that nukes must be limited and controlled. Are we in for a rough ride for the next few decades again? I mean, are we going to repeat history before U.S. and Russia will actually come to their senses and reach another agreement?
Well, once again, you're way ahead of me with the right questions, and those are the right questions. Do we have time to go through a generation of consciousness raising before we now deal with these nuclear threats? My answer would be no, we do not have time. I explain, I hope, why in this new book I have, because this new Cold War is very different and more dangerous than was the preceding Cold War. Personally, I think, and this gets me attacked in the United States, that Putin is such a leader, that he is ready and willing for a grand detente with the United States. But he's so mistrusted in the United States, it's not clear that there's any American leader who would embrace Putin as a partner, though it seems Trump wants to do so. So that's
I really
why
hope
we
you're
can't
right.
Turn our backs
I really
on
hope
Trump.
You're right.
There is no alternative.
Steve, that's all the time we have, unfortunately, for today. Thank you once again for this wonderful interview. It's a pleasure as usual. We're expecting you here sometime soon in Moscow. Take care of yourself. Say hi to Catherine. We were talking to Stephen Cohen, contributing editor of The Nation magazine, professor emeritus at Princeton University, and author of the book War with Russia, discussing what the U.S. pullout from the INF Treaty will mean for global stability. That's it for this edition of Sophie & Co. I'll see you next time.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.